Time for another check-in with the State Senator John Keenan of Quincy for an update on all things Quincy and Beacon Hill. Hey, John, nice to see you again.
Good morning. Great to see you. Actually, good afternoon. Great to see you.
That's right. Here we are again, still Zooming. And I know the legislature is still working that way too, right?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, even more so, there's been a greater emphasis on staying out of the building because of some individuals in the building who have tested positive. So there's a greater emphasis to continue to do things remotely.
Yeah, well, we're seeing things, unfortunately, tick up again. What do you think about the governor's latest rollbacks?
Well, I think I watched the governor's press conference, and we were in pretty regular contact with members of his administration. I think there's a frustration that was quite evident in his most recent press conference that the numbers are increasing, and that if people would just do their best to stay distant, to continue wearing their masks, that some of this could be avoided. But it's happening obviously all across the country. The numbers are spiking, the number of hospitalizations are becoming quite concerning, and the number of deaths continue to grow. So something has to be done, and the virus will be here. You know, we had our first individuals over in the UK receiving the virus yesterday, one of whom happened to be named Keenan, which was exciting to see.
The vaccine, you mean, right?
Yeah, the vaccine, yes. Yeah. So they were vaccinated yesterday for the first time. So there's promise with that, but it's still a long process, and people have to remain vigilant and doing what we all know we have to do.
The folks in the restaurant industry feel as if they're being singled out for, you know, causing the increase, and it's unfortunate that it is impacting them, I think, most harshly.
It absolutely is, and it's tragic. You know, restaurant businesses, in so many cases, are truly small businesses where people put their entire life savings and every waking hour into them, and to be in this situation is really, really terrible for them. We have tried at the state level to provide as much support as we possibly can, but a lot of it comes down to whether there will be additional stimulus money from the federal government that can make its way into the pockets of those who are running restaurants and other small businesses, help them get over the hump here. You know, it worked initially, and we haven't had that second round of stimulus or relief from the federal government. It's desperately needed. I know the talks are ongoing in Washington. I'm hopeful that they'll finally bear some fruit and we'll be able to help those individuals. And in the meantime, you know, doing takeout to help them is something that we can all do, but it's really a terrible situation.
Can you give us any insight into the state plans to distribute the vaccine? I know the governor will be speaking more about that today.
Yeah, so they have been working on this for quite some time, and in the state budget that was just passed, we had funding in there to assist with the dissemination of the vaccines. So it's a complicated undertaking, but we do have an infrastructure, a pretty robust infrastructure in place here in Massachusetts, because we have a great number of healthcare entities, both large and small, and so everything will be utilized in terms of how to get this out. The governor will release his plan, and you know, then we'll move forward. The key is making sure that we get it to targeted most at-risk populations first, and then we branch out from that. But I think that the bigger message has got to be that we need to do this, and that people have to take this vaccination if we want to move through the next few months and into next year in a better situation that we're in. And there's some interesting studies out there and reporting out there that show, because our levels are so high right now, while the efficacy of the vaccinations are what they are, the impact more in terms of across the country will be less, because we've got so many people who are at risk presently and who have the virus and being exposed to increasing numbers. And so while on an individual basis, we know the effectiveness of the virus, but its impact on how we combat this is lessened because we're going into it really in a tough situation.
Yeah.
Kind of intuitive, but.
Will people have to pay to get a vaccine?
The goal is not to have them pay. And I think some of those details are still being worked out, but the idea is, let's just get this thing out there. And so that's, you know, that's the primary focus at this stage.
If you mentioned
people pay, you open up a whole thing about what if people can't, but they're at greater risk. So, you know, the objective and the goal is to make it readily accessible to people and it's free. And if not free, then certainly that's covered by insurance.
Yeah, I know there's already a disparity when it comes to testing. Some people can get free tests, others have to pay depending on where you live and what kind of health insurance you have. So, you know, I'm sure you don't want to see that with the vaccination program.
Yeah. We want to encourage widespread use.
Can we talk, you mentioned the state budget, which was kind of passed unceremoniously recently. Usually there's a lot of fanfare about it and the reporting on it. Of course, it was 6 months late. That's part of the problem, right?
Right. And so why it was unceremoniously passed, because we are 6 months into the fiscal year and we were doing budgets on an interim basis throughout. And so the idea of a 12-month budget is something that we weren't focused on. We were focused on getting through the summer months into the fall, seeing where we stood financially in terms of revenues, and then crafting a budget that will carry us through the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th of 2021. And the budget is crafted to reflect what we've done to date and what we hope to do over the course of the next several months. It ended up being a better budget than what we anticipated. Revenues performed better than what we feared. Still not where we'd like them to be, but we were able to do a draw from our stabilization account, utilize some federal money that we had wisely saved, and with that, we're able to provide a balanced budget that is an increase over last year, and the increase is mainly driven by greater funded needing for mass health. With this pandemic, we have seen more people lose their employer-sponsored health insurance and end up on mass health, so a significant portion of our budget increase goes towards funding mass health. But the budget overall is up. We were able to do it with a combination of stabilization funds, federal funds, and the challenge will be next year if we don't get additional federal funding, FY22, which we are now in the budget process for. That's going to be a very, very challenging time. A highlight of the budget for me is that we were able to provide to our communities here in my district, in Quincy, Braintree, Abington, Rockland, Holbrook, and indeed throughout the Commonwealth, essentially level funding for local services so that we wouldn't have to have layoffs in police and fire and with teachers and librarians, and DPW workers. So we were able to provide level funding to our municipalities, in some case an increase because of cost of living. And we didn't think we were going to be able to do that back in last March or April. We were advising our communities to plan for cuts somewhere around 10%. So that we were able to provide that local aid is good for taxpayers and good for those that deliver our municipal services, our critical services.
Does the budget include any tax increases or additional fees?
No, nothing of any substance. One of the things it does is it does accelerate the collection of sales taxes. And so that was a one-time boost for our budget of $200+ million, but that's not a tax increase. So there was no increase in the income tax, nothing of that sort. So we were able to do it again with a draw from our stabilization account and some federal money. And fortunately, we were able to draw less from our stabilization account during this crisis than we did in the last crisis back in 2008 and 2009. So, and we had a relatively robust rainy day account. And we built that up over the years, and it's that work of building it up really helped us out this year.
As you know, the budget process here in Quincy has been finalized as well. There was talk about utilizing more free cash stabilization to lower taxes. Do you think that was possible at the state level as well?
We could have used, we didn't have to do any sort of tax increase at the state level. So that interplay that occurs at the local level between offsetting any dramatic increase in the levy with one-time revenues, it's a similar dynamic, but not the same at the state level, because we don't rely on the same formula that the municipalities do. And so our budget balance, requirement to balance the budget is really a function of adding up all our revenues and then our expenditures. And we have a wide array of revenues that we could increase by way of fee increases or tax increases. But again, we do on our stabilization account. It does create the same issue as what the local level will face next year, is that you build in a structural deficit each time you use one-time revenues for recurring cost. And this, I know, watching the council meeting the other night, I know that they discussed that. And I saw Chris Walker from the mayor's office highlight that, and some of the councils bring it up. And so, but it is something that has to be addressed, and we will face that next year. And that's why I say additional federal revenue will be critical to get us through and help us grow so that we can manage these structural deficits wisely.
Yeah. Of course, one of the contentious parts of the new budget was the police reform bill, something that you have supported.
Right. So, yeah, the police reform bill basically passed at about the same time that the budget did. I supported it when it came out of the state Senate, when it came before the state Senate, and I supported it again last week. There's a lot of misinformation out there or misunderstanding of what's in the bill and what's not in the bill. And we received literally dozens of calls and emails from people. One of the concerns that people have is that we are defunding police. That is just not accurate. There's nothing in the bill that defunds police. And in fact, the bill calls for a whole lot of things that are going to require additional investment in law enforcement. There was concern that the bill would result in police officers losing their ability to be police officers, their licensing, based on unsubstantiated claims. That's just not accurate. There is a due process built into this bill. If a process is initiated at the state level, then a police officer can say, time out, let's handle this at the state level, and have up to a year to, I mean, at the city level, they have up to a year to handle it at the city level. And at every step, an officer has a right to a hearing, to have counsel present at the hearing. There are appeal processes and steps up. There was concern that the board that would oversee police officers didn't have any police officers on it. That's not accurate. Three of the nine members are law enforcement. And I think there's a, you know, you can discuss whether there should have been more police officers on that board or fewer, but there are police officers on that board, despite people saying there's no police representation. And then there's, well, why are you treating police officers different than other municipal employees? And they always bring up teachers. Teachers are unionized and they have grievance and arbitration processes in place, but they're also licensed by the state. And the board that oversees teachers doesn't have any teachers on it. In fact, the statute prohibits anybody from an active teacher from serving on the board. And they have similar due process rights as what police officers do. In fact, police officers have more police officers on the board overseeing them. And the standard for taking an action, removing a police officer or taking away their license, is the standard of evidence that has to be met is higher than it is for just about any other profession. It needs clear and convincing evidence to decertify a police officer. And that's a higher standard than for many other professions. And they say, well, police officers are being picked on because now they have to be licensed. Other employees aren't. Teachers are licensed. People who work at the Department of Public Works in the water department and in other departments, whether they have a commercial driver's license or some sort of hoisting license, they're all licensed and overseen by a board. Public health nurses are. City solicitors are overseen by the board of bar overseers. So you just go down the list in most positions that within our city government are regulated and subject to licensure, and the police will be as well. So we hear a lot of those things that are out there, and they're just not accurate. We, with the bill, we try to strike the balance of making sure that police officers receive the training and education that they need, and that there are regulations in place that put a check on some of the practices that we've seen in other places in the Commonwealth and throughout the country, and that really promote a good policing. We're very fortunate here in Quincy and in my district and in most communities in Massachusetts, we have outstanding police officers, but we cannot deny that we have problems here in Massachusetts. And people don't like when I bring this up, but it, the response has always been, we're being punished for what happened out in Minneapolis. Well, we have a police department here in Massachusetts, the second largest, I believe, in the Commonwealth, the third, in Springfield, which the Department of Justice investigated. We continue to deal with the scandal in the state police on overtime and detail fraud. We had the past president of the state police on an unrelated matter, unrelated to overtime and detail, indicted for corruption. We have one police department fairly near here where half the police department had to be suspended for fraud issues. And there's a pretty long list of those things. And again, fortunately, they represent a few offices, not the great many that do go in and do their work. But I constantly hear police officers, and I agree with them. Good police officers don't like bad police officers. And this bill is designed to make sure that we support those good police officers and address these situations that arise when you have bad police officers.
One of the concerns I hear from folks in law enforcement is that it will deter people from getting into law enforcement in the first place out of fear of being sued.
Well, and right now, a police officer can be sued for just about anything, as can I, as can any of us. So they don't have any protections presently in place relative to being sued. They do have the ability presently under law when a lawsuit is filed under court decisions, when a lawsuit is filed against them, to seek to be dismissed under what they call qualified immunity. And that was a big issue back in July when the House and Senate passed their respective bills. In this bill, the final bill, the qualified immunity is addressed in two ways. One, an officer will not be able to avail themselves or assert qualified immunity if their offense had resulted in the loss of their license. Basically, if they had been a felony offense, they would not be able to then in a civil matter assert qualified immunity. And the second thing that we did in this, and this is a reflection of some of the work that was done back in the spring and into the early summer, was that we sent the issue of qualified immunity to a panel of experts to review and to make recommendations on how to best implement qualified immunity, make sure that it protects officers, but at the same time strikes the balance where it's just not a blanket reason to get out of a lawsuit. That was requested back in July by law enforcement. Myself and 13 other members of the state Senate supported an amendment to remove qualified immunity from our bill and send it to the committee. And this bill now does do that. So, I know I've heard all kinds of things that if somebody breaks somebody's ribs while giving CPR, they're going to lose their home. Just not true. That claims they're going to lose their license and lose their home for unsubstantiated claims. Not true. There are processes in place, as we talked about earlier. So, we want to make sure that we continue to track quality officers, that we give them a working environment that is supportive, that allows them to not have to deal with the impacts, the negative impacts of bad officers, and that policing as a whole will continue to move forward. And the great work that they've done will move forward to reflect the changes that we deal with in the society.
Will the new bill require any investment on the part of cities and towns, financial investment?
It should be substantial at the outset. For instance, cities and towns have school resource officers. That's another thing that we got a lot of emails from people saying, you can't believe that you're not going to allow police officers in the schools anymore. What this legislation does is that it allows a municipality to make that decision on their own, whether they want a police officer, a school resource officer present in the schools. And if they are going to do it, that school resource officer receives additional training on bullying, cyberbullying, relationships with administration, that type of training that they're going to need every day while they're in the schools. And so, we will work with providing and figure out a way to provide that training. Recently, we did put an additional fee onto car rentals where the money from that would go to police training. Now, car rentals have dropped in the pandemic, but there's also a lot of talk out there that we don't provide any funding for training and that we were cutting training. And I conveyed this information to several people. We've increased funding for training over the years, and we also tied it into a new fee to get additional funding for training. And we will use that to meet the requirements that we put in place under this legislation.
I know the governor's proposal back in the summertime included bonuses for additional training. Does this bill include that?
It does not. And, I would not have supported it as how the governor had structured it. We have, and I'm most familiar with the local contracts, there are stipends in most contracts for different licenses and certifications. If you're an EMT, you may get something added to your pay. For those types of things, there it's added. And then additionally, in Quincy by contract, in many other communities, particularly in response to the Quinn bill issue, there is an educational incentive already built into the contract where you get an incentive for different degrees. So that's in the in place in most communities across the Commonwealth now. And I think that's critical. It does promote officers going to school and getting education and training, which is very important.
Has the governor indicated if he'll support this? I mean, it's not veto proof, right?
It's not veto proof. So we don't know what the governor will do. I know that there's a lot of issues that have been raised by law enforcement, and the governor will weigh those carefully. One of the issues that came up was that this was rushed. Certainly the impetus of this was something what happened out in Minneapolis in terms of moving a bill, but many of the components of this bill were separate pieces of legislation. For instance, the post committee, the committee that will oversee law enforcement, that was a piece of legislation that went through the full legislative process, that had a full public hearing. Qualified immunity was a separate piece of legislation that went through the full legislative process and had a public hearing. And many other components of this bill went through that same process. Now, ultimately, at the end, when the conference committee reported the bill out and we had less than 24 hours to digest what was in that bill and vote on it, that was not as it should be done. And I voiced my concern and opposition to doing it that way. But nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to read the bill and to digest it, and to do so in the context of having spent a lot of time on it when it was before the Senate.
Who will actually serve on this new commission, John, and how will those people be appointed?
There are 9 members. There's a combination of how they will be appointed. It's 3 law enforcement officers. The attorney general has an appointment, and they will be chosen from names that will be provided. And so they will be the post committee that will make the ultimate decisions as to certification. And then within that structure, there's also a committee that's responsible for kind of personnel and training and developing the processes and procedures and policies that affect law enforcement. And that is made up of the vast majority of members of law enforcement. But on the post committee, there'll be 3 members of law enforcement. And then there are some other committees that are set up as well in the legislation. There is representation of law enforcement on that committee. And again, you could say whether it's too many or too few, but they are on that board.
Yeah. Are those paid positions?
They are not paid as far as I know. There will be an executive director, and there will be an organization that is established to support the board and to support the various committees that come under the board. I'd have to go back and check to see whether those individuals would be paid. I don't recall seeing a provision that they would be paid, but there will be an executive director and obviously an office established to provide support, and that will be, those individuals will be paid.
Okay. And does this apply to just new police officers or existing as well?
That's been the question about, will, if there's been issues of discipline in the past, will an officer now have to relitigate those matters, so to speak, before this commission? No.
Okay.
The information of past offenses will be provided and put into a database. But this is prospective, and the training requirements will be going forward, obviously. So much of it will be, it will take some time to implement this as well. And that was the other issue that was raised in concern about law enforcement. They were concerned about their disciplinary matters being put out in public, mm-hmm. and that they were being singled out for that. Well, first, their addresses and so forth, that personal identifying information, as far as where they live and so forth, that will be protected. But if there are incidents that have been sustained, they will be, part of the public record. And that's no different. You can go online right now and go and see whether a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer or teachers have any sort of disciplinary actions against them. As a member of the board of Bar Overseas, as an attorney, somebody can go on there and find out whether I've had any disciplinary actions against me. They can go to the Ethics Commission and request to see any actions that have been taken against me. And those are public. They can actually request to see my personal financial filings, and any complaints against me are public record. Same with Office of Campaign Political Finance. So, it's just, and a lot of, most states do this. But we're very sensitive, obviously, to the privacy concerns of law enforcement officials and their families. And that is a priority.
Interestingly, the Quincy delegation was split on this matter, which doesn't happen very often. Did that surprise you?
No, it was a difficult decision, I think, for all of us. And I think it got to the point where we weighed, you know, the pros and cons, and we each made our individual decisions. And I'd say if there was a common element to how we view this, is that we all value and respect the work that our law enforcement officers do here in Quincy, so as a delegation. But we just obviously had different perspectives and different views and different objectives in terms of why we passed this. I haven't talked to the delegation as to why they voted. I don't know why Representative Mariano voted the way he did, or Representative Chan or Ayers voted the way they did. We didn't discuss it. We individually looked at it, weighed everything, and made our individual decisions. And they were tough decisions, absolutely. And but we made those decisions, and I made it doing what I think is best to continue to ensure that our law enforcement officers remain the best in the country. We can't ignore we have problems. We have to address them. We have to be proactive. We have to stay ahead of the curve, and we have to provide police officers with resources and training and education that they need to stay ahead of the curve. And I know that they feel like, given everything that's going on these days, that they're just at the vortex of everything swirling around, and they don't feel that they're being supported. And I can understand that. I can disagree with it. I can understand their concern. As you know, I have many members of law enforcement in my family, so I fully understand it and I respect it. But you know, the goal from my perspective is we've just got to make sure we stay ahead of the curve. We live in a rapidly changing community and a rapidly changing country, and we've got to stay ahead of the curve.
All right. There's a deadline, is there not, for the governor to make a decision?
Yes, I think it's this Friday, but I'm not positive on that from the time that we voted and filed it with him.
All right. We'll wait and see. We talk about the MBTA, John.
Sure.
another set of problems there.
Yes. Everywhere you look these days, there's problems, unfortunately. So the MBTA, the status is now is that the MBTA management, the general manager, Steve Popchak, and his team put together a program to address what is expected to be a pretty substantial budget deficit. The budget deficit is between $500 and $600 million, close to $600 million. The last estimate I heard, I think, is $584 million budget deficit. And so the MBTA was looking at that deficit and looking at ridership and realizing that ridership had dropped significantly, and yet they were still providing service as if riders were riding it as they were last December, January, February.
Before, I think the governor said there were empty buses or buses with one or two passengers on them.
Yeah, and some routes, absolutely. And other routes, the number of people riding the buses has dropped, but has started to climb again. And it also depends on Green Line, Blue Line, Orange Line, and Red Line. There's different numbers that are riding those. And even then within, for instance, the Red Line, utilization at the stations is different, but across the board is down, and is down significantly. Commuter rail is really down, and the ferry that was running out of Hingham at full service levels at some point had seven people on the course of the day using the ferry. So the MBTA came up with a utilization driven approach that they would cut back services, and they would do so over a series of months depending on the type of service. They were prepared to present that proposal to the Fiscal Management Control Board last week. They postponed it for a week until this Friday. I think it's the 4th. Next Monday, the 14th, I believe it is, that they will present it. And there's hope that something will change in the meantime, particularly that we will get some federal funding. I've reached out to our congressional delegation asking them to push as hard as they can for federal funding for transportation so that we can avoid some of these cuts, but it's a difficult situation, and it's also going to be somewhat driven by the success of the vaccination and the success of us getting that vaccination out and then people returning to work. And even if that works well, that people get vaccinated, that they, you know, they have the ability to return to work, that we get the virus under control, there's still the issue of many people now wanting to work from home for some period during the work week. And there's a lot of talk about companies looking at a three-day, two-day model where people will be in the office 3 days and at home 2 days. Well, that's a 40% reduction in demand on public transportation, on utilization, a 40% reduction, if you want to do just simple math, of impact on our revenues. We don't know what our post-pandemic work environment and public transportation need is going to look like. And so it's fascinating. I'd like to see us use this opportunity to drive people to our preferred modes of transportation. And if you look at it that way, ferries from certain locations are some of the most cost-effective, least subsidized, most reliable forms of transportation. And we should look at driving people that live in certain areas to a ferry rather than commuter rail, for instance, or subways, or onto our roads. So I've expressed that to the Secretary of Transportation and to the General Manager of the T, and said, let's take this as an opportunity to shift the paradigm and move people to its preferred methods, modes of transportation.
Yeah. Do you think if the cuts are made that some will be brought back?
Yes. That question has been raised, and we have been assured that this is temporary, that is designed to save us, to kind of cut that deficit as much as possible, but always done with the idea that as utilization or the signs anticipating greater use are there, that those services will be restored. That's the goal. And I've asked the general manager to take a look at traffic volume data, for instance, that once the roads start to get clear, that's where people will go first, if they can avoid public transportation. And so once we see those traffic numbers increase, we should then get ready for a subsequent increase in public transportation, because when people end up sitting on the roads again for an hour and 10 minutes to go 10 miles, they'll shift their attention to public transportation. So we should use that data to drive our decision-making on the public transportation side.
Do you see, what do you see, John, as some of the silver linings here in your district out of the result of all this pandemic?
Well, it's tough to find them, but I believe they are there. I think there has been, it's tough to see it on social media, but to the limited degree that we're out and about, I see people concerned about their neighbors, making the sacrifices necessary to protect their neighbors from the virus. I see people helping out others, and sometimes it's just as simple as the person across the street got a package delivered, I'll put it in their porch, because we know that there's so many packages being delivered, there's concerns about them being taken. You see neighbors do those types of things. So some of them are just very basic, very simple things, but it highlights that people are good and they're willing to help others. And I see also, it's terrible what's happening in our local economy in terms of our restaurants. And we've got to figure that out. And I do think the key is for the federal stimulus. But I also see many of them remarkably doing creative things and adapting. And it's really a tribute to them. And I think we should make sure that we keep that in mind and show our appreciation for what they're doing. It's pretty remarkable. Small businesses, some of the ways they've adapted is so creative. Like, how do they think of that? And so you can't underestimate the commitment and the ability to change. And I think that's good. And I think it's also accelerated a movement towards greater use of technology, which will, I believe, have long-term positive impacts, not only in how we do our work, but also in hopefully freeing up some time for families and friends and those types of important things.
Yeah, do you think it's brought a greater focus on the environment and green energy and climate change?
I hope it has. Clearly, when it was shown that because of the reduction in the number of people going to work and utilize and driving in cars, it had an immediate impact on air quality. The numbers dropped dramatically. And that's been somewhat lost with everything else going on. But I think as we move through this and then take a look back and see where there are positives, that will jump out as something that we can control going forward. That if we are able to reduce the number of people who are driving in gas-powered vehicles, that we can have a dramatic quick impact on our air quality and our environment. So I think that will be something that we take out of this.
Anything else we should touch on, do you think, right now?
No, I just want to thank people for who have reached out. If they have issues with unemployment, accessing benefits, housing, in involvement with any state agency that they don't feel they're getting an appropriate response from, please call us at 617-722-1494 or send us an email at john.keenan@masenate.gov. And we will be happy to assist you. We've assisted literally hundreds of people. Sometimes we don't get the results as quickly as we'd like, but generally we get results. We're able to speed up the process. So please reach out. And then if people, you know, as we go into the Christmas and the holiday season, if they can just remember that it's caring for our fellow human beings, that if it means giving up, you know, a large Christmas gathering so that we can protect a loved one, that we do it. And, you know, people are saying it now, that it'll just make next year's Thanksgiving, next year's Hanukkah and Christmas and other celebrations that much greater. So if people can just please keep doing what they're doing, and we'll get through it.
I appreciate your time, John. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Be well.
Thank you.
And thanks for doing this. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.